Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Julie White. Julie is a mental health first aid instructor, neurodiversity coach and peer support facilitator, raising awareness of mental health and neurodiversity. Diagnosed with ADHD in her 40s, she reflects with hindsight on her own challenges with executive functioning and disordered eating. With both personal and professional experience, she supports individuals and organisations in fostering inclusive environments. Julie also recognises and navigates ARFID and disordered eating in her partner, offering compassionate support and understanding. This week, we talk all about Julie's experience of supporting a loved one with undiagnosed ADHD. We discuss the signs and symptoms that Julie recognised, as well as the impact this has had on her relationship and how she navigates this. I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Julie, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I've got a bit of a cold coming, I think, which I'm hoping isn't going to be any much more than that. So I'm not sounding as I normally would, but otherwise I'm all right, thank you. And it's great to be here.
Oh, bless you. Well, I hope it does stay as just a cold, but there's so much going around at the moment, isn't there, that I think we all just need to hibernate and kind of admit the fact that it's winter and that we don't need to be outside.
Definitely. It's definitely still winter.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know about you, but I'm looking out my window right now and it's thick pea fog. And it's been like that since I woke up this morning.
No, we have blue skies, but it's definitely, definitely cold. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm very jealous of the blue skies. So I really appreciate you joining me today. And I wondered if you wanted to just introduce yourself to tell the listeners a bit about what you, who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. So I the work that I do a mixture of things. I'm a mental health first aid instructor. So licensed with MHFA England to deliver the range of their courses. And I also deliver other mental health talks and courses and training. I'm also a neurodiversity coach specialising in supporting those with ADHD. As someone late diagnosed with that myself, and when I was on my journey at qualifying to be a coach, it became very apparent to me how much of a difference coaching made for me. And I really want to give back to those in a similar position. And I also volunteer in the mental health sector, the volunteer facilitator for peer support to people living with anxiety. So I do a very different mix of things all around the area of mental health and well-being.
Amazing. It sounds like you do so much. So yeah, I'm really grateful to have you on the podcast, and also thank you for the work that you do. And I know that we've previously spoken about ADHD, and I don't know about you, but my career has gone down the route of doing multiple different things. And actually, I really, really enjoy that from an ADHD perspective of kind of keeping me entertained and keeping me excited about things, because there's always so much going on and different things to do as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I thrive on variety. It's something that I've recognised throughout my career, that I am. The one time I really didn't enjoy work was when I was going to the same office Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. That definitely was not for me. I've learned that. So very much enjoy working for myself and having such a variety. It's a challenge at times, not going to lie, because trying to spin the different plates as it can get a bit overwhelming. But I wouldn't have it any other way, really. Now I love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. The corporate world was not for me. And it's funny because I love the diversity of being self-employed. But like you say, you do have to wear multiple hats and often thrown into things that, you know, maybe you didn't know that you were going to ever need to do. But I guess that's what keeps us engaged and excited as well, which is always good.
Exactly. Yep, definitely.
Yeah. So when we met, which was a couple of months ago now, we had a really nice conversation about our ADHD experience. And you also shared with me about your experience of your partner having ARFID. And I was really interested to talk to you about that, because I think on the podcast, we've spoken to researchers and we've spoken to clinicians about ARFID, and also people who have lived experience of ARFID. But we hadn't spoken to anybody who has supported somebody with ARFID. So, yeah, did you want to share a little bit about your experience there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think it's a very misunderstood condition, and I think it's also very underdiagnosed too. And I say that because my partner isn't formally diagnosed with ARFID, but the more I've learned and understood with the work that I do, both in mental health and with neurodiversity, is that it's extremely common. There's a huge overlap between neurodiversity and mental health. And as I think from conversation with you as well, is that often things don't get diagnosed unless it is a real problem. And that's not me saying that it's not a real problem for my partner, but it's not a problem enough for it to feel like it needs a formal diagnosis. But yet we definitely recognise that it meets, that the sort of the behaviours and the challenges meet the diagnostic criteria of ARFID. And so the more I've understood that, the more I'm very aware that it's not just fussy eating, as a lot of people might see it as from the outside. It's far more complex than that. It does need to be treated in a supportive way and an approach sensitively rather than in a dismissive way, which so often it can be. I'm sort of keen to, I've learned an awful lot living with somebody like that I previously would have seen it as fussy eating and thought, oh, what are you making such a big deal about? But actually, I've seen and lived with it and can see what challenge it creates.
Yeah. I think what you said there is a really important thing to highlight, is that, often ARFID is kind of just brushed off as picky eating. And actually it's so much more than that. And I think it's such an interesting thing, because it kind of comes up a lot when we're talking about eating disorders or disordered eating, in that people kind of just like, oh, just get over it, like stop being so silly. And that, I would say, is kind of said about all eating disorders. If somebody's struggling with anorexia, or just eat your food, stop being silly, or what have you. Or with ARFID, stop being picky, stop being silly. And it's weird that we have such a dismissive kind of outlook on it, when actually you can probably see that somebody is so distressed, and even if you don't see that somebody is so distressed, to kind of belittle their feelings in that way, it's just not something that I would ever imagine doing to somebody.
I think it also correlates a lot with neurodiversity, doesn't it, in terms of things like stop being so lazy, why are you always late for everything? It's a judgment made on something that's actually really, really difficult to manage, because it's something about who you are and how you're wired and how you're different from the typical. And that's where I think I see the overlap, because my partner definitely has particular sensitivities to taste and to texture that plays a big part into the particular foods that he avoids or finds challenging to eat. So it's there's a lot of sensory elements that, unless you've got that experience, it's not what you know. So you can be insensitive to those sensitivities if you get hungry.
Definitely. And I guess it doesn't make sense, but it kind of does make sense, because if you're somebody that hasn't experienced kind of those overwhelming sensitivities and things like that, then you would just be like, oh, it's just eating, like, I don't know what your problem is. But kind of, being able to address that in a more compassionate way, I think, is definitely important. And I'm just really intrigued, because you said that, for you, your partner hasn't had the formal diagnosis, but you recognize the symptoms. And, I personally think that is so valid. I don't think that in order to get support, or in order to sort of, label something, then you necessarily need that diagnosis. If it's something that you're struggling with, then therefore it's completely valid. But I'm interested for people listening, if they're thinking, I'm not sure if it is picky eating, or maybe it's something different, what the things were that you recognized in your partner?
Yeah, I think that the key things I've recognised very early on was that he had, so we've been together for 10 years, but very early on, he had quite a limited diet, I would say. The kind of typical beige foods, safe foods, as I would describe it now, but it was all very similar. It was nothing adventurous, I guess. And even when I say nothing adventurous, I mean, pizza was, it was a margarita pizza. That was as far as the extent of a pizza choice would be. No, cheese and tomato was that. Think about putting pepperoni on it. That was not happening. Vegetables, absolutely not. And we've moved further from there, but vegetables still won't be on a pizza. But pepperoni will, for example. But it's things like that. There was a very limited choice of food, limited diet, and very much all the beige foods or safe foods, or what we affectionately call ovenables in our household now. It's the things that you can just easily pull out of the freezer and stick in the oven without having to do much thinking either. Because there's also that side to the fact that he doesn't enjoy eating. He doesn't get enjoyment mm-hmm. from food, which I think is that other one of those other symptoms that I didn't realise was particularly linked to that, that food is functional with and not enjoyable for him in the most part too. So that makes it challenging, because you want to have a nice meal or cook a nice meal and enjoy it, but if there isn't really much enjoyment in that, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that element of enjoyment, I think, is often not kind of spoken about in terms of when somebody is struggling with ARFID. I'm really glad that you highlighted that in terms of like the functional aspect, because I think one of the criteria of ARFID, you know, is kind of forgetting to eat or not having the desire to eat or what have you. And it makes sense, doesn't it? If you don't find food pleasurable or you don't get any enjoyment from it, not necessarily that you have those overwhelming sensitivities or like the discomfort or anything like that. It's just purely you don't get pleasure from it. Mm. Kind of, well, what is the sort of pull to eating other than a functional aspect? And therefore, you kind of just, the purpose is to get calories in rather than kind of to make it delicious or, you know, taste nice and add different flavorings if that's not something that you enjoy.
Yeah, exactly. And I found that difficult at first, because I actually come from a hospitality background where I would have I've experienced a huge amount of variety of food. It was often part of my job to sort of quality test food when I was out working in restaurants, so I got very familiar with taste and food myself. So it was quite in contrast to that. And growing up as well, as a family, we would regularly go out to eat, because my dad's background was as a chef too, so one of his many careers in his time, but yeah, he was a chef for a time, and so eating out was really common for us growing up. But for my partner, that wasn't the case either, so eating out was often very challenging because it was new environment too, and all that uncertainty about what was going to be on the plate. Eating at home, eating safe beige foods, or ordering takeaway that is known takeaway would be our default, and still is a lot of the time, if I'm honest. Because there's no motivation to eat, and added to that, again, with not formally diagnosed but absolutely recognize the traits, I do have a formal diagnosis of ADHD, but he's never wanted or felt the need to, but he identifies as both ADHD and autistic, and there are those traits there where there isn't, that you forget to eat, you get hyper focused on something and the need to eat, suddenly you go, I need to have some food. But there's no particular motivation or desire, so it's the quick, easy options too. So it's a challenge at times, and certainly we've tried to explore. And he's very aware now that for his own physical health, yes, he's getting the calories in, but he knows that he's not necessarily getting the best nutrients for his well-being. And so, you know, there is that awareness to want to change, but knowing that that's not an easy thing to do.
Mm. Yeah. And that's such an important thing to say, isn't it, as well? Like, you know, a lot of the time people will be like, well, as long as you're getting the calories in, like, does it really matter? And, you know, quite apart from the fact that it's quite life limiting in terms of, you know, you're saying you can't go out to try new restaurants or try new foods or different things like that. But there's also that aspect of the nutrition element of, you know, missing out on whether it's micronutrients or macronutrients, and that having an impact on health as well. And you mentioned it kind of with, you know, the fact that have an interest in food and things like that. So I can imagine that has caused, you know, some adaptations for you. But would you say that there's been sort of prominent impacts on your relationship through your partner having I know you said it's not diagnosed, but I'm just going to refer to it as ARFID because I think that's what you said you would refer to.
Yeah, I would refer to it as that. And definitely there have been at times some real challenges, particularly, I would say, so when we've gone on holiday, so we're in an unknown place and we're looking for somewhere to choose to eat because we're not necessarily staying in a hotel. We've got a dog, so we'd have a dog with us and we'd be thinking, how do we cater or go out to a pub or something? And we'd have to look at the menu and find somewhere where we could see a menu on the outside before we even walk in, because there's that also that social discomfort of walking in somewhere, feeling that you need to sit down, look at a menu, make sure there's something safe to eat, that in terms of, he feels safe to eat, and then needing to say, and feeling frustrated actually of wanting to order a burger and chips that he's comfortable with, but knowing that he needs to have it plain and no salad on the plate and no this, no that. And there's an element also of them feeling that you're paying for a meal out when actually half of it you're asking to have taken off the plate as well. So there's an element of sort of personal frustration around it, but then also, limiting where we would choose to go, which, for me, I sometimes did find that and have found that frustrating. And then also there's been moments where we've needed to eat, we've stopped somewhere to eat, ordered something. I remember one particular time where I'd gone up to order because we needed to find a table with the dog, and I'd gone to the counter to order it, which was around the corner and out of sight. And he'd looked, quickly glanced at the menu, what to have, and then gone and sat down and left me to order. And I ordered him a jacket potato with cheese and beans. That was all safe food. What I didn't check, because it's not immediately in my mind, I didn't check as whatever garnish might be on the plate, and it came with coleslaw that was smothered in mayonnaise and sauce that was just leaking onto the potato. And it was, I would say, just in short, it was a bit of a meltdown moment. Those sorts of moments that can be really quite challenging and difficult, because I totally understood why he felt how he did when the plate arrived, and he just couldn't eat it. And it just became that uncomfortable moment eating out of how do we ask for that to be replaced and make sure that it's a completely fresh meal and not no coleslaw on the plate. And the dynamic that then creates of guilt from me that I hadn't checked, and frustration from him that I hadn't checked. And it's challenging at times to make sure that we remember those things. It's got better over the years, and when we openly talk about those challenges, and we both learn to make sure we ask and feel more comfortable about asking when we sit down and eat a meal out. But it is difficult, because people don't necessarily understand why you're saying, please can I have that not on the plate or in a side dish so I can try it. It's that's one particular instance that really sticks in my mind, because it was a challenge.
And I mean, I haven't had experience of ARFID, but I can completely relate to those instances where, and often for me it would tend to be when everybody's reached that point of hunger, when you are very much wanting to have food, and then it's the inconvenience of the eating disorder pops up again. And only last week when I was on holiday, I had the same thing of going from one restaurant to the next, looking at the menu, and just because I'd gotten to a point of high state of anxiety, just nothing was coming to me that says, that's what I would like. And my partner did get frustrated, and it's very difficult, as you've explained there. And I think it's a similar situation of, you have that frustration of, God, why can't you just eat? I wish we could just sit down. But then equally having the compassion and understanding of what's going on. And then equally the person who's struggling being, I wish I could just eat, but equally, this is really difficult for me, and I know that I'm not going to be able to face that. And I guess I just wondered, because you said that things have gotten better over the time, how you've sort of learned to, learn more about ARFID, but then also learned more about each other and that communication to make sure that when you do go, if you do go out for dinner, that those situations are kind of as calm and as pleasurable as they can be.
Yeah, it mostly comes down to a bit more planning, because it is when it's the unplanned, we've been out all day, we haven't planned where we're going to eat, that those challenges arise. So it is down to more planning. And that's a challenge in itself with ADHD, because neither of us are particularly good at planning. And having snacks, making sure that we have got snacks for those hangry moments. Even when we go to visit family, and I might not have ever properly shared that with them, but sometimes we will stop at services and make sure that he's had a burger at the services before we reach to my family's house for a meal. Just because much as my family will do everything to prepare something that is going to be something that he's comfortable to eat, he's still never quite sure. So it puts him at ease to know that he's eaten something, so he's not going to sit there and feel hungry. And he can try whatever's put in front of him, but not feel the pressure to have too much or equally get too hungry as a result. So it's about just, planning that and not getting to the hangry stage without a solution, really, which is, learning curve, definitely. And it's much more, researching the menu, checking what places we can go to for food. More planning is probably the biggest thing, really. But talking about it and understanding it, which probably up until about 6-12 months ago, I hadn't even really properly heard of ARFID. I'd heard of the term, but I'd never really delved into what it meant. And when I started to explore more about, particularly about sensitivities, because that's one thing for him in particular, is flavours. I'd buy jars of sauce to be able to do a simple bolognese, for example, and he would look at the ingredients and say, oh, it's got peppers in it, I can't eat that. Even though, to me, I couldn't taste peppers in it. He could immediately taste peppers in that, and that is one thing that he's recognised he absolutely can't tolerate. So it's those small little things of needing to check labels, needing to double check what's in something, and actually starting to try to do more cooking from scratch, so we know exactly what's gone into food as well when we're making it at home, because that then means that he feels comfortable and confident with what we're having. Another interesting one is onions. He I mentioned peppers, but onions is another thing. He likes the flavor of onions, but it's the texture of onions. And big lumps of onion, so it can be in there, but it needs to be absolutely, I've got a mini chopper, mini blender that minces it up so small that you just won't get the texture, but he's happy with the taste. So it's those little adjustments that we've kind of learned when we've been in a safe, comfortable place to try things, and trying recipe boxes that have helped us have a little taste of something, and then I'm still getting the vegetables that I know I want and need, and he's getting to try something and working together with that. Because that's also a real challenge when it's just the two of us. The motivation to cook is really difficult when you're having to cook two different meals, or you're each having something completely different too. So that's an added challenge in the relationship dynamic. But just learning and accepting that we won't eat the same thing, and that's perfectly okay. But that's not how most couples would expect to eat. You'd expect to eat together and eat the same thing, but that's very rarely what we do.
And I mean, I think it's great that you have that sort of, openness to the fact that there's those sensitivities, and really being able to navigate those so that you're both getting from food, what you need, but also what makes you feel comfortable. And it's very interesting as well, you mentioned the food boxes or recipe boxes, because from an ADHD perspective, they have changed my life, because rather than having to plan food, it I choose it on the menu and it comes, and then cook it. And for me, that's also been a really good part of my recovery in trying new foods. But I just wondered, and I mean this from a completely compassionate place, it's just more of a kind of query in terms of your personal perspective. So you said kind of like, at home you'll try different foods, but then also there's that understanding that, your partner won't eat certain things, and so you will have them in your food but not in his. Would you say that your hope for the future is that he would be able to kind of engage with any foods and go out to restaurants or what have you? Or is it kind of a that's never going to happen, but we're kind of trying to manage as we can?
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's a really good question. And I totally appreciate it's asked with compassionate curiosity. I'm a great believer in that approach to any question. And I would say, gosh, wishful thinking it would be to think that we could, every single meal we eat would be eating the same thing together and not needing to even question what ingredients have gone into the dish. I don't ever expect that to be the case. but a happy medium. I would say we are able to go out to more restaurants with more variety now than perhaps 5 years ago. So that definitely helps. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to food at home, one thing we've managed to start to do, because another challenge for us has been up until about 4 months ago, he was doing shift work. So we also didn't eat at the same time because of different shifts. And so we've started to do a lot more batch cooking. And so cooking meals where there's a batch cooking meal that he's quite happy and comfortable with what's going on in that main dish. And then I can have that but add vegetables on the side to mine, whereas he would have it without any vegetables on the side. So it's that, those sorts of adjustments, we were way further along than we were at the beginning of our relationship in that respect. But I don't think we'll ever get to the stage, and I'm just being realistic if I'm honest, I don't think we'll ever get to the stage where I could just whip up a meal with any and all sorts of ingredients from the fridge and he'd happily eat it. I don't expect that to ever be the case, because of the fact that I recognise he has got those additional sensitivities to flavour and taste and texture that I don't expect to ever go away. That's part of who he is. So I think it's just always about being mindful of that and being kind to myself where I've made a mistake, and him being kinder to me where I haven't realized that something is in there. It's just that greater awareness, the more you understand, the easier it is to be compassionate and considerate. The less you understand, and the harder it can be. So we went out to friends recently for takeaway, and the idea of us having a curry together was suggested, and that was a challenge in the fact that we didn't know what the takeaway, it was a new takeaway restaurant that we hadn't used before. So having those conversations with friends as well to say we might need to just order pizza if that's okay. But we did, we were able to try those things and explore those in the comfort and safety of friends that know and understand as well. I think that's the key too. It's when you're around people that don't know or understand and who are most likely to go, "Oh, you're just being fussy," or "What are you making a big deal about it for?" Because that then just creates that added anxiety to the situation. So that's then when the avoidance comes in too, and not engaging in social activities because of the not knowing if there's going to be something there that you can eat, or that there's going to be something that's going to set you off into a state of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, such a nice outlook in terms of the fact that I think with Arvid, the biggest thing I've recognised from when I've spoken to other people is just having patience with yourself and your loved one, in that, you know, you said over the past 5 years things have really improved. Unfortunately, when we're being realistic, it's not going to be the case of automatically someone's going to start eating a new food and therefore every single fear that they ever had around food is gone. It does take time, and I think that having compassion with that and being patient, it actually makes the process easier, because as you've said, as soon as there's judgment or, you know, there's difficult situations, that's where the avoidance comes in. So as difficult and as challenging as I'm sure it is of having the added difficulties of Arvid, actually being able to be compassionate will kind of really help somebody on their journey of trying new foods. And I think also what you were saying about having people that understand, I know, again, my experience hasn't been Arvid, but I know that when I am with friends who I feel understand, and, you know, maybe they've not had their own experience, but they're compassionate towards me and the fact that I am trying and that things can be difficult, that often makes me feel a lot more comfortable to try new things, but also kind of motivated too as well, because I've got the support of people around me.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to ask, in terms of when you have occasions when you're with people that don't understand, how you handle those? Because I think, you know, we kind of spoke about it at the start with the misunderstandings around ARFID, and I can imagine that that can be quite challenging if you're trying to eat around people who don't quite get what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's not something that I would typically, you know, I wouldn't call it out in front of my partner, most definitely, you know, because I wouldn't want to create that sort of scene and anxiety. But I'm comfortable to, I guess, because of the nature of the work that I do, I'm comfortable to challenge misconceptions and to help educate others that it's not just fussy eating and that there is genuine fear, anxiety, concern that creates an avoidance. I think because of the work that I do in peer support as well, I have other examples that I can share and talk about when it comes to misunderstandings and misconceptions as well. So it's a big part of the work that I do, so I don't have any issue calling it out, really, I suppose. But it's definitely something that a big part of what, when I do call it out, I say, using that words of compassionate curiosity, really, I recognise that I've learnt a lot in recent years, and education is key, and you can't expect everybody to know and understand everything, especially if they've not experienced it or understood it. So it is about gently educating people about how it is a genuine condition, and it's often not seen or not understood because those anxieties are hidden or avoided in public and in around other people. You don't know, people will choose the safe foods or avoid the situation. So it's the kind of classic situation of you don't see it, so you don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a important thing to note there. And I think also we have still got the misunderstanding that if someone's struggling with an eating disorder, they're underweight. And so I think that, you know, that difficulty then arises if people are like, well, I see you eating and your weight's fine, so how can you have an eating disorder? Which, again, I don't understand how anyone could ever say that. I mean, I can't imagine ever saying to somebody, well, you don't look like X, therefore you can't have Y. It's just something that I can't ever imagine saying to somebody. But I think what you were saying about sort of that compassionate curiosity, that's so important. And I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about how to communicate like childhood body image concerns and things like that. And we were saying how often it can be so tempting to get on your soapbox and, you know, tell someone you're an absolute idiot. Like, how can you possibly not know about this? How could you say something like that? Blah, blah, blah. But that confrontational approach to it is kind of the worst thing you can do, because somebody will then just kind of put their back up and not want to hear your perspective. But actually being able to be curious about their thoughts and, oh, you know, that's really interesting that you think that way, like, do you know where that came from? And then also sharing your experience in, as you say, a very compassionate way, I think can actually turn the conversation around, because that kind of entices people to listen. And you never know. I think one thing I always think is, you never know, you having that conversation with somebody, yes, in the moment, hopefully that's going to help you. But equally, it could be someone down the line that, because you've had that conversation with the person that's spoken about your experience and how it can impact people, it may then help them understand the perspective of somebody else as well that's going through a similar thing. So I think being able to approach it calmly and kind of explain and try and understand their perspective as well can be so helpful when having those difficult conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, coming from it from a place of going, I used to think like that too, until I learned, or until I experienced this, or until I had a conversation with someone about that. And that helped me see it in a different perspective. And now I understand so much more about it. Just starting from there is kind of positioning it to say, it's okay to not know that. Because we can't possibly know everything about everything, and every day, you know, is a chance to learn something new. I was about to say every day is a school day then, and that was my one of my phrases. I say that, no, it's not. That's very literal. It's not, but every day is a chance to learn something new, and we can't be expected to know everything. So yeah, there's always a chance to learn and understand it and be better and do better. One of the words I use to describe how I look back at former me is with hindsight. You know, hindsight with a K rather than hindsight with an H, because now that I know and I understand myself better, you know, when I think about my ADHD diagnosis, I used to beat myself up for, you know, mentally for being late for everything. Now I'm very aware that that is something that is a huge challenge because I have complete time blindness. My concept of time is not the same as most people. And that is a challenge in itself. And, you know, I remember you sort of touched on that. So you don't look like you have an eating disorder, for example. I remember one of the friends I first told when I got my ADHD diagnosis, she said, but you're the one of the most organized in our group. I wouldn't have, you know, a group of friends. I said, I wouldn't have put you as having ADHD. I'm like, no. What you're not appreciating is that the outward indications of organization is a huge amount of effort to be organized. It doesn't come naturally. I have to put all of these things in place. So I, yes, I may appear organized from the outside, but that's, if it didn't do that, it would be chaos. So yeah, it's understanding that there's this, it comes back to that point of more planning, more preparation to make things easier, and to be, create that supportive structure and environment for things to be more manageable and less stressful, because we all function better when we're in a calm state than when we're in an anxious state.
Absolutely. I love what you were saying there about, well, I had exactly the same thing. Someone said to me, you can't have ADHD, you don't fidget. It's like, one, are you a psychotherapist and are you giving me a diagnosis? And two, like, you may not see me fidgeting physically, but my brain is fidgeting extremely, like it's very fidgety right now. And also the thing about organization, it's like, yeah, because I've had 27 years of having to be hyper organized to navigate the distress I get if I'm not being organized. So I think it's completely ridiculous when people say like that. But I love the thing about kind sight and really having compassion for yourself, you know, when looking at situations that maybe haven't gone as planned or you didn't have that understanding. And I think that would be really great advice for people who are supporting somebody with ARFID, in that, you know, you're not expected to understand everything and you're not expected to kind of cure somebody or have all the answers. But, you know, being there, being a support for somebody and also having support for yourself and understanding that you don't know everything. Like you said, I think by having that calm approach to it, we all do better when we're calm. And so that would really be helpful for people that are navigating this and supporting their partner with that as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Julie, for sharing your experience. It's been so lovely to speak to you and to, you know, learn all about the things that you and your partner have gone through. And I think that this has been really helpful. So I really hope that the listeners have enjoyed the episode. So thank you so much. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, Hannah. You're so welcome. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.